everyone, and welcome to Reverb.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Reverb. Welcome to Reverb. Hey, hang on a second. Calvin, I thought I was introducing the show today.
No, I'm pretty sure we agreed that I was going to do the intro for this one.
Wait, when did we decide that?
Okay, I mean, it's not so much that we decided it as a collective decision. I just thought it was kind of implied that I would introduce an episode like this, you know?
No, I don't quite follow you.
I mean, not to be too blunt here, but Alex, I've kind of got you topped in terms of sheer credentials.
Like what?
Okay. You really want me to go through this? Okay,
yeah.
Just to name a few things. I've got a lengthier publication record. I'm teaching at an R1 school while you're at a small liberal arts college. I teach grad students. You only teach undergrads. I have seen many more Martin Scorsese films than you have. I just feel like I have a bit more authority to introduce a show like this.
Now, hold on a second, Calvin. We both have PhDs from the same institution. We graduated the same year. We even worked with the same people in our program. We even shared an office and had the exact same number of books on our shelves. 11. That's all we could afford. I mean,
that is true.
Yeah, we've been co-producing this show for exactly the same amount of time. Doesn't that count for anything?
Maybe to you, but what about our audience, Alex? I mean, I'm just saying, I feel like I'm someone that our listeners can trust a bit better. Like, when you hear the confident tone in my voice, my precise enunciation of each word, you just know that I'm packing a 20-page CV. The audience is thinking, man, I really need to listen to what this guy is saying. He's a real expert on this stuff.
Okay, I'll give that one to you. You do have a great voice. You've got the credentials to back it up, but what about me? I'm still just sitting here. What am I supposed to do? I mean, what am I? Chopped liver?
Well, according to Google's AI assistant,
liver is considered one of the most nutrient-dense foods in the world and is a rich source of many nutrients, including vitamin A, protein, B vitamins, iron, selenium, copper, and vitamin K.
This is a highly credible and authoritative source. I trust its ethos, Alex.
You know, Calvin, I'm not sure we quite agree on our definitions of credibility and ethos. I feel like we're going to need to do a deeper dive into the rhetorical concept of ethos and maybe explore some of the ways that speakers and writers build and maintain credibility with their audiences. And who knows, maybe by the end, our listeners can judge who really had the proper ethos to introduce this episode. The term ethos is a Greek word which generally translates to character or disposition and functions as the etymological root for the English word ethics. However, far from being a broad concept like ethics, which for us today involves assessing the justifiability of certain actions or policies, the original term had a much narrower definition, being linked to how a person's character was defined in a particular time and place. Some of the earliest accounts of ethos being used rhetorically come from its place of origin in ancient Greece, and more specifically in Athenian courts of law. In these courts, the notion of getting a lawyer to represent you and your case did not exist, at least not in the form that we know of it today, in which you pay someone a fee to rhetorically perform in a manner favorable to your cause. Instead, it was more common for Athenian citizens pleading their cases to hire a logographer or speechwriter to help them develop, or in some cases fully ghostwrite, their complaints or defenses. According to many historians of rhetoric, the speechwriter Lysias was one of the first to refine a technique called ethopoeia, in which virtues and other elements of a speaker's character were telegraphed through their speech. Dionysus of Halicarnassus described Lysias' use of ethopoeia like this. He could make his client, quote, appear trustworthy by referring to the circumstances of his life and of his parentage, and often again by describing his past actions and purposes. And when the facts fail to provide him with such material, he creates his own moral tone, making his characters seem, by their speech, to be trustworthy and honest. When used in the courts, putting ethos into practice in a speech meant invoking not only the facts and details of a person's past that lent them credibility to their audience, but also proving their character in the moment as they were speaking. Thus, ethos was necessarily a part of the entire rhetorical act, from the invention and arrangement of core ideas to their oral delivery in the court. It also, importantly, implied that an individual's self was something that could be performed publicly to be judged as credible and virtuous, or dishonest and shameful, by an audience. This practice of performing virtuous selfhood is not at all unfamiliar to us today. Lawyers will often use any rhetorical means at their disposal to make their client appear trustworthy and upstanding, or at the very least pitiable, in order to gain favor with a judge or a jury. Beyond courts of law, we see this in everyday discourse as well. Sometimes speakers will adorn their prose with mellifluous accenture and grandiloquent vocabulary in order to project a rarefied and ostentatious air. Okay, in plain language, they'll try to sound fancy and confident in order to seem smart, just like that. If this version of ethos feels a bit slimy and distasteful to you, you're not alone. The notion of a seeming self, one that could emerge from the artificial mask of language, was something that the philosopher Plato criticized vociferously in his writing. For Plato, language and rhetoric needed to be aligned with the true nature of a given speaker in order to project ethos. To make the point clearly in his Socratic dialogue Phaedrus, he has Socrates deliver two speeches, one profaning the concept of love and another praising it. In delivering the first argument, Socrates covers his face to symbolize the fact that he does not believe the words of his speech. By having Socrates cover his face, the symbol of his self, Plato makes a subtle point that the virtuous Socrates could not bear to look into the eyes of his conversation partner Phaedrus and say words he did not believe. In today's language, we might say that he couldn't get through it with a straight face because his words did not reflect the true nature of his character. Plato's student Aristotle, however, was much more comfortable granting credence to the notion that a person could perform their ethos in rhetorical discourse. In fact, he argued that the concept of ethos could provide a useful starting point for developing arguments. For Aristotle, ethos was a key artistic proof in a speech, meaning that it needed to be developed entirely within the speech itself. Through their discourse, he argued, speakers could give the impression of being trustworthy and morally upright through various rhetorical techniques, particularly in situations where the audience was not already familiar with the speaker's prior reputation or facts of their history. It was thus less important for speakers to ensure that their words aligned with the true nature of their selves, as was Plato's chief concern. It was far more expedient for speakers to align the appearance of their ethos with the values of their audience. To give the appearance of a strong ethos, Aristotle outlined three qualities he deemed most persuasive and impactful when represented in speech: phronesis, or practical wisdom, arete, or civic virtue, and eunoia, or goodwill. These three qualities are not universal. Virtue, wisdom, and goodwill all mean different things to different audiences. The key challenge for a speaker is to determine what these values look and sound like to the audience, and then attempt to embody them effectively when they speak. This might sound like a complicated task at first, but it becomes easier when we think about how to navigate any social or political issue that involves different stakeholder groups, people with differing types of power, experience, and interests in an issue. Consider, for example, that you are a parent addressing a school board meeting where budget cuts are being discussed. How do you project your ethos effectively to make a difference in such a rhetorical situation? The answer, depending on the audience of other parents and board members you are addressing, might involve striking a balance between different kinds of phronesis, arete, and eunoia. You might, for example, choose to represent your goodwill or eunoia to the audience by talking about how you have previously advocated for reforms concerning the well-being of all the children in your school district, not just your own. You might convey your practical wisdom or phronesis by showing that you understand how school budgets are shaped by municipal taxes and state funding, and that you know board members have to act within certain constraints in order to make smart decisions about how to use limited resources. And you might represent your arete, or civic virtue, by appealing to the values of the community of which you are a part. On a personal note, back when I lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I might have invoked the concept of virtue by talking about how we can be good neighbors to one another, since Pittsburgh has very distinct neighborhoods with their own unique character, which residents often recognize as part of their own identities. And perhaps this concept of being a good neighbor, I could argue, involves balancing an education budget so that our school funds help the largest number of students in ways that will materially improve our neighborhood, such as maintaining funding for free lunch programs over the summer or after-school programs that provide kids with entertaining, pro-social, community-oriented activities to engage in once the school day is over. The previous examples and Aristotle's definitions highlight a fascinating feature of rhetorical ethos. That is, it encourages us to think not only about how our own character will be judged by others when we speak or write, but also how to interpret the character, values, and interests of those others, and consider how they might align with our own. The concept of ethos thus encourages us to think carefully about how our public selves are mediated and interpreted through discourse, and to reflect critically upon how we read other people and respond accordingly to them in public venues. This is necessary in order to maintain their trust, because this is what may truly lie at the heart of an ethotic rhetorical relationship, and what is most at stake when we use it in speaking or writing. Whether or not we can establish a mutual trust with our audience, our peers, our family members, friends, and community. A more contemporary rhetorical theorist, Kenneth Burke, took the concept of ethos a step further in his work A Rhetoric of Motives, in which he describes a key element of persuasion which he calls identification. According to Burke, quote, "You persuade a man only insofar as you can talk his language by speech, gesture, tonality, order, image, attitude, idea, identifying your way with his," end quote. Persuasion, then, becomes a kind of flattery, which involves the speaker making themselves feel consubstantial with their audience, or on the same level with them. Taking things even one step further, Burke reconfigured ethos as a kind of manipulative tactic, rooted in group psychology, that speakers or writers could use to make themselves seem as though they are in an in-group with their audience, and typically define themselves against a perceived out-group which threatens them. One easy example of this kind of persuasion by flattery comes from the TV series The Wire, in which the fictional Maryland State Senator Clay Davis, played by the actor Isaiah Whitlock Jr., is brought before a grand jury to stand trial for embezzlement and wire fraud he has committed from various charities he claims to support. Ordinarily, throughout the show, Clay Davis's speaking voice sounds like this.
"Your people are apparently pulling finance reports and checking up on some of the contributors. I wanted to reassure you on that front. I'm not involved in drugs, Lieutenant. This business with Mr. Price, this is a misunderstanding that is really of no concern to the police."
Davis is officious and businesslike in his manner when speaking to other people in positions of authority, enunciating each word with precision and using an almost legalistic vocabulary to talk through complicated matters. When he gets in front of the diverse, multiracial grand jury of Baltimore citizens, however, his rhetoric and his presentation of ethos changes considerably. When his lawyer asks him questions about money it appears that he funneled to himself from one of his charities, he answers like this.
"For example, this check for $11,000, dated January 22nd.
That was last winter, right? So, some went to pay everyone's BGE. 'Cause half my district was gonna have the heat turned off. And then some went for puff jackets for them that got children in need. Let me tell you something, man. My neck of the woods, it's a jungle out there. Everybody living hand to mouth, improvising, hustling, make do with as little as you can imagine. Hell, that TV show, Survivor? Man, they want some good contestants. They need to come around West Side. Folks I know, oh, we do great on that show. Practice every damn day of our lives. Hell, and Fear Factor? Oh, shit. Don't even get me started.
Forgive me, but I still don't understand how that justifies...
Let me tell you something, brother. I don't know how they do it out in Roland Park. Maybe Prosecutor Obanda can enlighten me on that. But my world is strictly cash and carry, and I am Clay Davis. My people need something, they know where to find me. Let me tell you, brother, I step out the door, hit the corner of Mosier and Pennsylvania, you better believe my pockets are bulging. But by the time I get to Robert Street...
Objection! Objection, Your Honor!
In this clip, Davis not only infuses his dialect with elements of African-American vernacular English, such as dropping the N's off of ing verbs, modifying his vocabulary choices, and alternating his inflections of various words, he also references experiences and places that would be familiar to audiences in and around West Baltimore, such as recognizable place names, the high costs of energy in the winter, and the less formal use of, quote, cash and carry to pay for goods. He also identifies himself as being in the same in-group as his audience, using inclusive language like folks I know, we, and our lives. And crucially, he distinguishes himself from the prosecutor who is bringing the charges against him as someone who is from Roland Park, a notorious wealthy suburb north of Baltimore known for its explicitly segregationist redlining practices. After delivering his testimony, the grand jury clears Davis of the charges, forcing the prosecution team to concede.
What the fuck just happened?
Whatever it was, they don't teach it in law school.
Perhaps not in law school, but take any rhetoric course on Kenneth Burke, and you'll know exactly what Davis was doing. His manipulative presentation of his ethos helped him identify with his target audience, the grand jury of Baltimore citizens, and recast his high financial crimes as a Robin Hood-esque tactic of informally spreading funds to poor people in his district. While this was, in the show, revealed to be a lie, you can still find comments on the YouTube video for this clip saying things like, "We need more men like Clay Davis out there helping people with puff coats and paying for the asthma doctor. God bless him. I wish my rep was Clay Davis. Instead, I have a swamp monster. You know how good Clay is at this? I know what he did. I've seen it. But at the end of the speech, I believed him." Kenneth Burke was writing about the manipulative aspects and destructive consequences of ethos in the mid-20th century, a poignant reflection on the horrors of two world wars, and the role that rhetoric played in developing the dangerous ethos of hyper-nationalist strongmen in Germany, Italy, and elsewhere. In 21st century rhetorical theory and criticism, ethos has remained a concept of sustained interest to scholars, particularly those who are interested in rehabilitating its productive rhetorical power. In the 2004 collection, The Ethos of Rhetoric, edited by Michael J. Hyde and Calvin O. Schrag, scholars investigate the role of ethos in a wide array of contemporary and historical texts, using as their guiding principle a pre-Aristotelian notion of ethos as a dwelling place in which people can find commonalities with one another. Reconfigured this way, ethos provides a more positive orientation towards social good in rhetoric. It foretells the possibility of using rhetoric to establish common ground and encourages us to use this possibility as a point of critique against the opportunistic and exploitative appropriations of ethos used to divide and demonize others. In that spirit, contributors to this collection use the concept of ethos to analyze its positive uses as a common dwelling place, as well as critique its malign uses. Eric King Watts, for example, examined how members of the Black Arts Movement in the U.S. during the 1960s developed an ethos known as Black Aesthetic that afforded African Americans a dwelling place for making sense of their struggle for self-determination and self-definition. Martin J. Medhurst examined the role of religious rhetoric during the 2000 U.S. presidential election in constituting a democratic ethos for the American presidency, and David Zarefsky critiqued the ethos projected by George W. Bush in his speeches following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. In each of these selections, the invocation of ethos as a dwelling place for speakers and audiences to find common ground with one another was emphasized as a positive ethical norm for rhetorical scholarship, one that offered new possibilities for how we might analyze uses of ethos that bring us together or tear us apart. This notion that ethos can function as a dwelling place also implies that a person's character is not a tightly controlled resource that is solely projected from the rhetor's bully pulpit. Contemporary rhetorical theorists have more usefully characterized ethos as a kind of relationship between the speaker and the audience, a contextual element of discourse that readers and writers, speakers and listeners, co-construct together. neither the rhetor themselves nor the audience is fully in control of what a person's ethos consists of. It is a constant flux between how a person presents themselves, how others talk about them in public, and how the audience makes sense of the identity of the person. In essence, this rhetorical appeal is itself the product of arguments, ongoing public debates about how we should think about the reputations of significant people in our society at various levels.
Outside of courtrooms and deliberative proceedings like school board meetings, perhaps the most ethos-saturated settings in our contemporary political system are elections. By ethos-saturated, I mean that in an election season, we are constantly reminded of the critical importance of ethos. Politicians proclaim their good character traits like public virtues, practical experience, and positive policy goals for their term in office. They try to identify with the voting public and constitute their campaign as a dwelling place for various core constituencies, and they villainize opposing candidates and political adversaries as evildoers and threats to the Republic who must be defeated. At the time of this recording, the 2024 U.S. presidential election campaign between Joe Biden and Donald Trump is beginning to heat up. In New York on May 31st, the Republican candidate, former President Trump, was convicted of 34 federal crimes. Currently, Trump is scheduled to be sentenced in mid-July, just before the Republican National Convention. A recent poll by Politico suggests that 21% of independents are less likely to support Trump than they were before the convictions. Meanwhile, President Biden seeks re-election amid cascading international crises in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon, as well as in the war between Russia and Ukraine. Biden's administration has contributed massive military, economic, and diplomatic support to Ukraine and Israel, and yet these wars do not seem likely to end in resounding victories for U.S. allies anytime soon. Nevertheless, Biden enjoys the political benefit of relative economic stability inside the U.S., at least as compared to the 2020 election cycle. Another benefit to Biden is the extremism of his political opponents. U.S. voters have already experienced a full term of President Donald Trump from 2016 to 2020, which followed an extraordinarily close election in 2016, when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by millions but lost narrowly in the Electoral College, after her campaign had openly accused Trump and his allies of colluding with Russia to illegally influence the election. During that same 2015 to 2016 cycle, Trump's approach to conservative politics revolutionized the Republican Party, driving Republican legislative candidates and state and local politicians further and further to the far right. The Trump presidency that followed was chaotic and abnormal for many reasons, so it seems fitting in retrospect that its final year, 2020, was defined by a once-in-a-generation catastrophe, the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, the interregnum between Biden's victory in November and his inauguration in mid-January 2021 saw the events of January 6th, when thousands of Trump's most radicalized supporters violently attacked the Capitol building on his behalf. Thus, as context for the current election cycle, it is important to note that the post-2016 era has more or less revolved around Donald Trump, and it has all been filtered through increasingly partisan cable news media, defined by the separate bubbles of Fox News for the Republicans and MSNBC for the Democrats. In addition, many voters receive their political news from Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter algorithms that overwhelmingly serve content to reinforce rather than challenge people's pre-existing partisan beliefs. It is here that we can begin to see the enduring analytical utility of the concept of ethos. In current politics, presidential campaigns construct their ethos in large part on social media, through official campaign accounts and influencer accounts. As a case in point, consider a popular pro-Biden influencer on X, the website formerly known as Twitter, @BidensWins. The Biden's Wins account was created ahead of the midterm elections in January 2022, and it currently boasts around 390,200 followers. Its bio describes it as, quote, "the largest online community of President Biden's supporters," unquote. The bio also claims that the account's purpose is, quote, "keeping score of President Biden's wins," unquote. It is noteworthy that quantification is invoked in both sentences of the Biden's Wins bio, first in the conceptual metaphor of keeping score, and second in the unsourced assertion that this is the largest Biden supporter community. This emphasis on quantity over quality is echoed in the rhetoric of the accountant's posts, which follow a standard format exemplified by the following from June 16th.
Breaking. For the first time this election cycle, President Biden is leading the majority of major polls in Wisconsin. This is a huge turning point for the campaign.
Most of Biden's wins, 5,625 posts, begin with the all-caps single word breaking, followed by a colon, which evokes the style of breaking news posts from journalists on X. Typically, each Biden's wins post mixes some factual news with pro-Biden commentary. The campaign spin is hardly concealed at all. As such, it is clear that this account does not seek to represent political news objectively or in a bipartisan way. Instead, it seeks to republish news relevant to Biden's presidency or campaign, give it a pro-Biden spin, and increase its rhetorical velocity. Rhetorical velocity, according to Rodolfo and DeVos, involves consideration of, quote, how a text might be recomposed and why it might be recomposed by third parties, and how this recomposing may be useful or not to the short or long-term rhetorical objectives of the rhetorician, unquote. Rhetorical velocity connects to ethos in the sense that rhetors strategically compose in order to maximize useful recompositions that increase their credibility and public reputations. In the case of Biden's wins, bits of news are strategically reframed as positive signals for Biden's presidency and his re-election chances later this year. By the same token, the Biden's wins account applies rhetorical velocity strategies to negatively frame news about President Trump and his party and get it to go viral, all with the ultimate goal of harming Republicans' public ethos. For example, on June 18th, the account posted,
"Breaking. Donald Trump's post-presidency biographer is coming forward to let Americans know that Trump has severe cognitive deficiencies. Oftentimes, Trump couldn't even remember his author's name. Retweet so all Americans see this."
Similarly, on June 19th, the account posted,
"Breaking. Mitt Romney just announced that he will not vote for Donald Trump. Romney makes it abundantly clear Americans should not vote for a convicted sexual abuser. Retweet so all Americans see this."
Across posts like these, we see appeals to authorities, such as Trump's biographer and Senator Mitt Romney, which seek to draw a negative character contrast with Biden. They associate the positive moral and epistemic authority of these figures with Biden while dissociating them from Trump. By invoking Trump's biographer and a politician from his own party, Biden's wins implies that if these people, who are so close to Trump, question his fitness for office, then so should all Americans. The repetition of the phrase "all Americans" captures the most striking aspect of how Biden's wins constructs the Biden presidency and campaign ethos. In short, Biden's wins promotes an explicitly jingoistic, pro-America ethos for Biden. On the one hand, this is consistent with Biden's long history of conservative stances. For instance, multiple candidates in the 2020 Democratic primary, including then-Senator Kamala Harris, criticized Biden for opposing busing programs that helped desegregate public schools in the 60s and 70s. Biden also openly and strongly supported the Iraq War during the early 2000s Bush years, among many other conservative policy positions. This is why he was specifically chosen as then-candidate Barack Obama's running mate in 2008 to present a conservative contrast to Obama, who was perceived by voters as more progressive and liberal. So, when it touts Biden's uber-patriotism, Biden's wins is reflecting the values of the politician is promoting. But on the other hand, as shown in earlier example posts, the goal of this account's rhetoric is to draw as strong of a character contrast between Joe Biden and Donald Trump as possible. And this raises an important question. Is it possible to outflank the ethos of a hard-right hyper-nationalist like Trump on jingoistic patriotism? Biden's wins seems determined to test the theory that it is. This is evident from a particularly odious series of recent posts related to immigration policy. On April 11th, Biden's wins posted,
"Breaking. President Biden is set to announce an executive order to limit the number of asylum seekers allowed entry into the United States. President Biden is taking action because Republicans are too cowardly to pass the strongest border protection legislation in history."
On June 3rd,
"Breaking. President Biden will sign an executive order that will allow the U.S. government to deny asylum and deport immigrants who cross the border illegally. Reminder, Republicans voted against the toughest border security legislation in decades."
And on June 4th,
"Breaking. President Biden just slammed Republicans for failing to take action on the border. Because of this, President Biden announced an executive order to deny asylum requests for immigrants who cross the border illegally. Retweet so all Americans see."
Keep in mind that for readers on X and for those who encounter these posts recirculated on other platforms, all of them are framed by this account's username, Biden's Wins. A policy decision that harms many thousands of people is framed as simply a win for President Biden. This promotes the cynical idea that Biden's approval rating and poll numbers are more important than the well-being of immigrants seeking asylum. But there are other troubling ethos appeals embedded in these posts. For example, the phrases "too cowardly," "strongest," and "toughest" imply that Biden is brave and strong for enacting anti-immigrant policy. This implies, of course, that advocates of more humane approaches to immigration are weak cowards by comparison. There is a further effort to associate character traits of masculinity and dominance with Biden, and weakness and femininity with his political opponents, the GOP. Obviously, these are ideological associations that are not innate or natural, as it arguably requires a great deal more political bravery to support immigration in the current political climate than it does to oppose it. To suggest otherwise is, ironically, to associate political bravery with Trump, whose 2016 policy platform was headlined by his promise to build a wall between the US and Mexico. Trump has always made anti-immigrant bigotry central to his political ethos, which makes these questionable ethical appeals for Biden fans. But this is not a contradiction that is limited to a fan influencer account. Reinforcing the Biden's Wins messaging, on June 18th, Biden himself used the @POTUS account to post the following.
2 weeks ago, I did what the Republicans in Congress refused to do. I took action to secure our border. I restricted unlawful crossings and enabled quicker decisions on asylum. And since we implemented my order, border encounters have dropped about 25%.
This crass quantification, dropped about 25%, echoes the Biden's Wins account's consistent emphasis on scoring and numbering. It is very unclear what a 25% drop in border encounters means in real or material terms, but it sounds to this critic like Biden is bragging that he has made the border more inhumane by a factor of 1/4. Trump, too, loves to brag about numbers and size. The size of his military budget, his tax cuts, his contributions from big evangelical donors, his poll numbers, and more, with no consideration of morality. What, therefore, distinguishes the Biden ethos from Trump's? Overall, it is unsurprising that the Biden campaign is using social media to intentionally craft an ethos that is pro-Democrat and anti-Republican. Perhaps more surprising, however, is that they are explicitly dissociating their campaign identity from immigrants and people who care about them. Would corresponding ethos analyses unearth similar findings in regards to young people, people of color, and Arab and Muslim Americans? These are important communities that the campaign may need in order to defeat Donald Trump in key swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania. But the Biden 2024 campaign does not seem to be a dwelling place for such folks. Instead, it has chosen to identify him with the border, the flag, the military, and the police, in an attempt to make him more credible and trustworthy to upper-middle-class and wealthy voters in the suburbs. When, in November, voters in all of their diversity and complexity turn out to vote, or don't turn out at all, these ethos appeals, which circulated across X and cable news in the preceding months, will influence their election day decisions. This analysis is significant because it reveals some of the ways in which poll obsession, social media algorithms, and polarized cable news have structurally transformed the electoral sphere. Biden's campaign is not constructing his ethos according to classical values and virtues. Instead, it is playing a cynical game of poll leveraging and scorekeeping. Under this model, ethos is a kind of fungible, hypermediated concept that candidates rhetorically brute force to their audiences through any means necessary. The question of this approach's success, however, remains open, especially given that all rhetoric's ethos is co-constructed by audiences and subsequent recompositions. All in all, we hope this episode has illustrated why, from the ancient Greek polis to contemporary partisan politics, ethos is a crucial tool for rhetorical criticism and strategic decision-making.
Our show today was produced by Alex Helberg and Calvin Pollock, with editing work by Alex. Reverb's co-producers at large are Ben Williams, Sophie Wadzak, and Olivia Burnett. You can subscribe to Reverb and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website at www.reverbcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is at ReverbCast. That's ReverB_CAST. If you've enjoyed our show and want to help amplify more of our public scholarship work, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and tell a friend about us. We sincerely appreciate the support of our listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in.